Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is June the 24th, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Let me add one more thing to that. Do you mind if China may have access to your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. Zoom CEO Eric Yuan sparked a wide backlash earlier this month when he said on an earnings meeting that Zoom would not offer end-to-end encryption to the company's offering for free users because it wants to work together with the FBI, with local law enforcement, in case some people use Zoom for bad purposes. You had to know there would be a huge negative response. The reason given made no sense. All you have to do is require all users to verify who they are before use. Zoom has now taken a big step towards damage control. They have since backtracked on the controversial plan to offer the heightened security feature only to paying customers. Zoom responds to privacy backlash by giving all its users end-to-end encryption. End-to-end encryption is considered one of the most private ways to communicate online and allows users to have secure conversations without anyone, including the platform they're speaking on, have access to the data. Zoom will be making true end-to-end encryption available in July. Encryption has long been a sticking point between tech companies and law enforcement, and companies such as Apple and Facebook have pushed back against demands to allow access to their platforms. Rights group says Zoom shut down its account after Tiananmen Square anniversary event. Privacy concerns have dogged Zoom since late March, when the company acknowledged its video meetings did not have true end-to-end encryption, despite marketing material indicating it did. Zoom responded by freezing all new features for 90 days to work on security issues, and they acquired secure messaging firm Keybase to help shore up its encryption capabilities. And offering encryption to all its users has become even more important for Zoom, which was built as a remote workplace tool, but is suddenly being used for private events such as birthdays, funerals, government meetings, and other activities. As Zoom rolls out the feature, free users will be asked for additional information to verify their accounts, such as a phone number. Users can currently sign up with just an email address to reduce the mass creation of abusive accounts. End-to-end encryption will also be an optional feature that Zoom users must enable because it can limit some features, including the ability to dial in through a phone or record meetings. Encrypting large video conferences is also a bigger challenge than encrypting text messages on smaller conversations, which services like WhatsApp and Signal already offer with a one-on-one connection. The message or core data is secured on the sender's device, and only the receiver's device has the key to decrypt it once it arrives. Put simply, the more pairs of connection or ends, and even the free version of Zoom can accommodate up to 100 participants per meeting. If you think about what Zoom is doing, they are collecting all the videos, all the voices, putting it together, displaying them nicely. It does get harder exponentially as the size of the meeting grows. I've been using Google Meet of late. It is very much like Zoom in function and navigation. At the present time, it's free. The big problem with Google Meet is the lack of specification. That's a fancy word for documentation. Google never seems to have documentation for any of the products that they've introduced. From what I have experienced, unlike Zoom, with a time limit for free users, there is none with Google Meet. As a first look, comparing Zoom to Google Meet, if you're familiar with the use of Zoom, you'll be able to transfer that knowledge readily to use Google Meet. If you are currently using Zoom, I would not switch over to Google Meet to avoid confusion with participants joining existing meetings. But if the time limit on the free use of Zoom is a factor, switch over to Google Meet. If you don't like the idea of your meeting or meetings going through servers that the Chinese government can access, then obviously switch over to Google Meet. At the beginning of the week, news was released that Google had partnered with industry leader Parallels to provide a workplace solution for employees that need to access Windows applications and files from the cloud-centric Chrome operating system, aka Chromebooks. This is big news for Google. Many enterprises have already made the shift to the cloud by adopting Chromebooks and shifting a lot of their daily computing tasks to the Google Cloud platform, but they still depend on specific software solutions that run only on Windows devices. Parallels Desktop 15 for Mac runs Windows on the Mac, and this version of Parallels will be adopted to run on the Chromebook. It is optimized for the latest Windows 10 updates, and Parallels runs thousands of Windows programs on this platform. It includes Parallels Toolbox Essential Utilities for the PC. Parallels is a software virtualization company now partnering up with Google to bring full Windows software to Chromebooks. The recently reported partnership would see application software such as Microsoft Office and other full-feature Windows apps running in Chrome OS. The focus of the collaboration, of course, will center on efficiency, connectivity, speed, reliability, security, and undisrupted access. The effort by Parallels and Google will ensure a proper path to deliver these programs while continuing to embrace the forward-thinking mindset of any cloud-based business. The goal of Parallels is to bring legacy software to platforms that cannot said software run natively on a Chromebook. It is a major undertaking. Many companies still rely on some form of Windows software, but are making the move to the cloud and are already in a position to cut ties with locally installed software. These companies often find themselves in a place where one or two pieces of the puzzle prevent them from completely severing the umbilical cord. Whether it is a point of sale, inventory control management, or one of those applications where you got to fill in the blanks, it's normally one piece of software that a company is so invested that it keeps them tied to Windows, and that's why Parallels will be an important player in the evolution of the Chrome OS and Google's platform for enterprises. Parallels for Chromebooks might arrive as soon as Chrome OS 85. Parallels is a company that specializes in OS virtualization to bring full-feature Windows applications such as Microsoft Office to the Chrome OS. All of that would be presumably in a virtualized environment. Right now, users on Chromebooks rely on mobile or web variants of Windows apps to accomplish associated tasks. That's not always a viable solution since those apps don't always offer all of the native software features. The announcement, however, indicated that this feature will launch on Chrome Enterprise devices. By the way, that means business systems only. And we don't know if at all it will ship to consumers as well, but we certainly hope it will. There's also more work that's being done. Parallels seems to be running under some software called Plug-in VM. Google's been working on Plug-in VM for at least over a year now. Plug-in VM is intended to allow users to install custom virtual machines, but is targeted to enterprise users only at the moment. Plug-in VM will also create a folder directory called myfiles/plug-in-vm in the Chrome OS Files app for sharing content between the two containers. This is very similar to what Google does with Linux, which of course is in beta test right now with the Chromebook. All of these are exciting developments for sure, and we're bound to see more of these little tidbits in the coming months in the feature goals ready for release. Chrome OS 85 is expected to hit the stable channels on September the 1st. It's normally one piece of software that a company is so invested that it keeps them tied to Windows. And that's why Parallels would be an important piece of the puzzle in the next evolution of Chrome OS and the Google's platform for enterprises. However, it is an evolution, not the be-all or end-all. Microsoft has seen the writing on the wall. The company has been tinkering with lightweight Chrome OS alternatives and evolving many of the company's major software platforms, such as Office, to offer web-based solutions as more and more users want and need an on-the-go solution that is accessible from anywhere. In the end, Windows apps on Chromebooks will be a win for everyone involved. We're still a few months out from actually seeing Windows apps on Chrome OS via Parallels, but it will be limited to enterprise users. However, I have a caution for everyone. Don't get too excited about this project. Chromebook users are looking for a simple answer in getting that one Windows application on a Chrome OS device. It will be the stepping stone to what is next. What that looks like is anyone's guess, but it's exciting to see, and I feel that Chrome OS will be right there in the middle of it all. A major hurdle for this partnership to succeed is the total cost of operation. The least cost copy of Parallels is $60. Whether this is going to be part of the price that Google pays, I don't know. Parallels is a sandbox that is isolated to run the Windows 10 operating system. There are three editions of it: Standard, Pro, and Business. The least cost for the consumer public would be the Standard. Now you also need to purchase a licensed copy of Windows 10. It would not be surprising that you may need to purchase Windows 10 Pro. Let's say the cost is $40, and that's very low because that's what I found doing a search. But at that price, I would be very concerned whether or not it is legit. One other thought is Parallels need at least 8 gigabytes of RAM to run. Very few Chromebooks today are sold with that much memory. When you add up the total cost of operation, you may be better off just sticking with a Windows 10 system. But if there's an app on the Chromebook and it's not available on the PC, you may opt for a Chromebook equipped to run Windows 10 applications. Introducing Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. He is covering the subject, Conferencing Calls Lack Standards and Security.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for business. This is where I give you some of my past experience, my current experience, as a 30-year IT professional. Now, this next item kind of crosses a lot of different areas, including business. It started in business, conferencing calls. I want to talk about this is from a conversation I had recently in regards to why do they all have like different setups and why is it all kinds of weird and why do we have problems with security with them and all just a bunch of things. Our browsers, they all work on a primary language called HTML, Hypertext Markup Language. And this has been embraced by all of the different players in the game. What happened was they set up the hypertext markup language as the vehicle for us to move the information. So if you're working with Safari or SeaMonkey, whether you're working with Firefox or Waterfox, Chrome or Komodo, and just so you know, that's a bunch of different web browsers. You're familiar with Google Chrome, and maybe you're familiar with some of those others. But they all will work mostly the same. They all use that HTML standard. They're going to be broken up a little bit. They're going to have slightly different representations of the information. But for the most part, they will work pretty much the same. Web conferencing is different. There are so many different competitors in the market, and it's going to be a battle to see who comes out on top. Why is it going to be a battle? Because for many years, it's been an option out there, and we have used them, but we haven't used them on a daily basis. So if we're talking about the big one, Zoom or WebEx, Skype. You're familiar with that, hopefully. GoToMeeting. There's a number of others as well. There's AnyMeeting, FuseMeeting, iMeet, OpenMeetings. There's Microsoft Teams and TeamViewer. And it's kind of odd that Microsoft Teams has their own thing when Microsoft owns GoToMeeting, but this list goes on and on and on. Each of them developed their own proprietary way of moving this information that we utilize. Now, you would think that the standard would be common, but it's not. There are no standards because they're all running a proprietary set of codecs. What is a codec? It's a coder decoder. All right, in HTML, we go back to that HTML for a moment. HTML, when it delivers a web page, it's delivering that hypertext markup language to our browser. It's a set, plain English, mostly plain English, set of instructions. It works just like, you know, hey, make this bold. Okay, great. Now this line is bold. Now let's unbold it. And that's all there is to it. It's simple language to learn. However, it's also small. When we look at a web page, we might be looking at 30, 40, 50K worth of information. Some of the longer pages might go up a little bit more. And then we're looking at the individual pictures, common standards for something called JPEG, something called GIF. In case you're wondering, yes, I call it GIF, not JIF. JIF is the peanut butter. Anyways, we go into this kind of framework here, and it's all set up, and it's been working for a long time. But it's not proprietary. It's open source. The standards in amongst the web conferencing, it's all proprietary. They code the information, that video information, a lot differently. Video, just so you know, works out not in kilobytes, but it's megabytes per minute. So there's a lot to this. And this is something where you're sending that information out. Your computer is encoding it and then sending it out to the other 10, 15, 20 people where they decode it. And they're also encoding their own. And then now your computer has to decode the information from 20 different computers. So this is something that turns into a battle because there is no standard. There isn't going to be for a while. What we're going to see, because it's all proprietary, is we're going to see a lot of people flock to one particular web conferencing unit or another. Even the granddaddy of all of this, WebEx, they were founded in 1996. But for many years, they focused on the corporate market. Even today, we actually didn't go with the old geezer, the old granddaddy. We went with Zoom. A lot of people went with Zoom, which went from 10 million basically daily callers to 200 million daily callers in a matter of a few weeks. And that number is kind of stifled because they had some security problems. So why security problems? Well, because we're moving this information, and it's all in different codecs. It's all in different forms of how we're moving the video, the audio, and encoding that in a secure manner is a problem. Additionally, we wind up with problems where each of these folks is doing their own security, their own little way. So, yeah, all you have to do, all you had to do was guess a Zoom conference number. And you were most of the way there. WebEx at least has, you have to have the WebEx number, then you have to have the password, which can be set by the person, the host of the meeting. And we go from there. This is all going to be something that everybody's going to sort out over the course of the coming months. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Windows XP was introduced in August of 2001, and support after 12 years ended in April of 2014. Windows 7 was introduced in July of 2009, and support after 10 years was finally ended in January of this year. Migration of Windows XP to Windows 7 took a long time, as most people were comfortable and familiar with XP as an operating system. Moving of applications and data from Windows XP to Windows 7 was not a simple process. A major problem was that many lost track of where they had stored the distribution media for installed applications. You had to reinstall the application. You couldn't just move the application from one machine to another. Keeping the same peripherals required change in the software drivers, if it was available from the manufacturer. Migration of Windows 7 to Windows 10 was a repeat of the same technical angst of moving from XP to 7. Deploying Windows 10 upgrade is simpler than with previous versions of Windows. When migrating from earlier versions of Windows 10, an easy in-place upgrade process can be used to automatically preserve all apps, settings, and data. And once running Windows 10, deployment of Windows 10 features updates will be equally simple. The trick is moving from Windows 7 to Windows 10. The primary advantage of staying with first Windows XP and then Windows 7 was that after the initial phases of installation, Windows XP became the de facto stable release. It took a while before Windows 7 became the stable de facto release. Human nature as it is with computing, and that is, if it's not broken, don't try to fix it, or try to tweak or make changes with it. For almost 20 years, Windows XP and Windows 7 didn't change much. There were SP or Service Pack releases, but they were primarily a recap of fixes. Where there were enhancements, it did not alter the operating navigation. If an increase in performance was needed, many just opted for hardware upgrades rather than spending for a new system. You could swap out component parts. The downside of all this was the perceived notion that the PC was dead. People were upgrading hardware and not making new hardware purchases. Many added memory for increased performance. Soon we were replacing hard disk drives with solid-state drives. The hardware upgrade path reflected in a major drop in new sales of PCs. To a large extent, the ability to upgrade was an impediment to new PC purchases. Based on U.S. government website traffic, 75% who use PCs are running Windows 10. Nearly 1 in 5 visitors, that's 20%, who use PCs are running Windows 7. Windows XP, predominantly, along with Vista and Windows 8 account for the remaining 5%. But these numbers are very misleading. The statistics are based on internet traffic. Medical devices, ATMs, customized hardware and applications, which are not connected to the outside world, are not included. There are those who are not crazy about having the latest technology and is happy with XP in business. The primary concern is profit, not necessarily using the latest technology. Even so, that would put the number of machines running Windows XP at a staggering 140 million around the world. Computer World estimates that 30% of Windows machines, almost 500 million to be specific, are still running Windows 7. That's a massive number. Over 80% of medical imaging devices run on outdated operating systems. Microsoft's recent sunsetting of Windows 7 accounts for most of its use in older medical equipment. 56% of imaging devices run on Windows 7, which gets limited support and patching from software now, and another 27% of these devices run on the long-dead Windows XP, as well as old and decommissioned versions of other embedded software. MRI machines can be as cheap as $150,000 or as expensive as $1.2 million. For a state-of-the-art 3-Tesla MRI machine, the price tag to buy one new can reach $3 million. The room that houses the machine, called an MRI suite, can cost hundreds of thousands more. Can you imagine a hospital administrator asking for funding the purchase of a new MRI machine because he's running the existing MRI machine with Windows 7? The machine is still functioning fine, but he would like to use the latest operating system. That doesn't fly. Today, the vast majority of ATMs worldwide use a Microsoft Windows operating system, primarily Windows XP Professional or Windows XP Embedded. Microsoft upgrades the Windows 10 operating system twice a year. Since its introduction in 2015, the upgrades to the operating system takes place in the spring and fall of each year. Microsoft defines an upgrade as moving your PC from a previous version of Windows to the latest version. An upgrade can take place on your existing device. Google introduced the Chromebook in 2011. Unlike the traditional PC, it is cloud-based. A Chromebook is a laptop or tablet running the Linux-based Chrome OS as its operating system. The devices are primarily used to perform a variety of tasks using the Google Chrome browser, with most applications and data residing in the cloud rather than on the machine itself. Chromebooks run Chrome OS, Google's operating system. Google provides app support with heavily featured Google Suite of applications relying on a working internet connection. The movement to more online-centric processes has decreased the dependence on physical hardware. We no longer need to store media in our laptops and phones as we can access them online anytime. Our important work documents are stored in a cloud-based drive or are safely backed up in our emails. Cloud-based data processing can be done even without high-end processors on the side of the user. When you are online, you are always using the latest version of the Chrome operating system. When a Chrome-based system needs to be reinstalled, it's a simple process. Laptop manufacturers recognize an opportunity to take advantage of this movement, and they are releasing laptops that rely heavily on online services. Without the need for high-end hardware, these laptops called Chromebooks were exceptionally cheap and lightweight. These laptops were made for users who spent most of their time online. The number of users of the Chrome operating system has reached 25 million in the previous year. With the coronavirus pandemic, the education system was turning to major purchases of Chromebooks for students without access to a PC at home. By the start of spring, Chromebooks were out of stock. The rise of cloud computing over the internet continues to change the landscape of technology. Internet technology is faster than ever and has become far more accessible. Internet access is no longer limited to personal computers. A huge portion of internet users access online content through their mobile phones. The change in how users access the internet has led software developers to come up with lightweight mobile apps that are less demanding of the device's hardware. Some applications have even come up with or completely migrated to online alternatives. Nowadays, most of what we do is done through the online platform. Streaming of music and movies, storage of files on the cloud, online banking, online shopping, and social networks. Although we may not have noticed it, this movement to more online-centric processes has decreased our dependence on our physical hardware. We no longer need to store media in our laptops and phones, as we can access them online. Our important work documents are stored in the cloud-based drive or are safely backed up in our emails. Cloud-based data processing can be done even without high-end processors on the side of the user. Laptop manufacturers recognize an opportunity to take advantage of this movement, and they have been releasing laptops that rely heavily on online services. Without the need for high-end hardware, these laptops called Chromebooks were exceptionally cheap and lightweight. These laptops were made for users who spent most of their time online. Chromebooks run on the Chrome OS, which operates on top of the Linux platform. They are fast, secure, and like most traditional laptops, can be used by multiple users. In the early days of Chromebooks, manufacturers focused on making them small and lightweight and were generally only available in 11.6-inch screen sizes. Nowadays, Chromebooks are as big as 15.6-inch screen sizes, and they're readily available. Practically every single popular computer brand has come up with their own Chromebook, including HP, Acer, Dell, Lenovo, Samsung, among others. So where am I going with all this? The focus of Chromebooks on internet-based services will force users to do things differently. Even mundane things such as printing a document which has to go through the Google Cloud print services, and watching a movie, which can only be done through a streaming service such as Netflix, have to be done through some sort of online component. This can take a little getting used to. The current implementation of Windows 10 is that it is upgraded in increments twice a year. This will enable the PC user to be mostly up to date and not be faced with a massive conversion task. This is especially true with major corporations needing to synchronize the upgrade of hundreds and thousands of PCs with a new operating system as quickly as possible or about the same time. This reduces the technical deployment of personnel by Microsoft to maintain different legacy systems. This is also in part to the challenge by Google in which the Chromebook is always using the latest operating system. So what is there not to like about this approach? Microsoft schedules upgrades twice a year. There are delays in the process when a major problem in the release that was not discovered in the original testing. 6 months between upgrades is not really a lot of time for quality control and usability testing. The latest news released by Microsoft is that there is a Windows 10 2004 glitch, meaning what came out in May, there's a problem. Microsoft admits bug breaks storage spaces, corrupts files, and as I have reported a few weeks ago, this build is, in my opinion, a disaster. Microsoft has confirmed another problem that could happen after installing Windows 10 version 2004. Despite extra testing of the Windows 10 May 2020 update, the rollout has already thrown up multiple driver problems. The company has warned Windows 10 users that they may see a compatibility hold on the Windows 10 2004 upgrade if Microsoft determines that their machine's configuration is impacted by the bug. Storage spaces is a feature of Windows and Windows Server that supports systems with multiple drives and let users bundle up separate drives to create a pool of storage space and protect data. Devices using storage spaces might have issues using or accessing their storage spaces after updating to Windows 10 version 2004, otherwise known as the May 2020 update, and Windows Server version 2004. When using some configurations, partition for storage spaces might show up as raw in Disk Manager. Microsoft advised, and they strongly worded this, against running checkdisk, that's chkdsk command, that's a DOS command, on any devices affected by this issue. The new warning follows multiple reports about storage space issues. Users receive multiple error reports when attempting to use the storage spaces management interface after installing the feature update. Others reported seeing corrupted partitions and damaged files. Microsoft says there is no workaround for the issue, but it does provide instructions for IT pros to set storage spaces to read-only and block systems from writing to storage partitions. Microsoft says there is no workaround for the issue. Your device will still be usable, and any volume not seen as raw should be readable. Microsoft is investigating the issue and will provide an update when more information is available. It has not listed the issue on the known issues page for Windows 10 version 2004, which include various unresolved driver incompatibility issues. Microsoft only began rolling out the Windows 10 May 2020 update just in the past few weeks, version 2004, to mainstream users. So far, Microsoft has listed 10, that's 10, open investigations into a range of bugs affecting peripherals, Bluetooth, mouse input, and graphics processing unit driver and display issues. How widespread each issue is remains unknown, and while Microsoft hasn't yet confirmed the problems, it has provided workarounds for some of them and has implemented compatibility holds for 9 of them. For each of the compatibility holds, Microsoft advised against manually installing Windows 10 2004. It's not uncommon for driver compatibility issues to arise early after a major Windows 10 rollout. However, it was hoped that Windows 10 2004 would be a smooth update given Microsoft spent an extra 6 months testing it with Windows insiders and hasn't added any major new features since ending development in December. After the botched Windows 10 1809 rollout, and that was about a year and a half ago, Microsoft revealed that the Windows driver ecosystem consisted of 16 million unique hardware driver combinations. Microsoft has found that certain versions of drivers for Realtek Bluetooth radios aren't compatible with Windows 10 2004. It's implemented a block on the Windows 10 2004 rollout to devices with affected Realtek drivers until they've been updated. Microsoft advises against using the Update Now button or the Media Creation tool until the Bluetooth issue is resolved. Synaptics and Microsoft have found incompatibility issues with some versions of the drivers for Conexant or Synaptics audio devices and Windows 10 2004. To safeguard your update experience, they have applied a compatibility hold on Windows 10 devices with affected Conexant and Synaptics audio drivers installed from being offered Windows 10 version 2004 or Windows Server version 2004 until the driver has been updated. Microsoft is also blocking the Windows 10 2004 update for PCs with Intel integrated graphics processing units. The companies are working on a fix in an upcoming release. There's a stop error with a blue screen that occurs when plugging or unplugging a Thunderbolt dock with certain settings enabled. Again, Intel and Microsoft have found compatibility issues with Windows 10 2004. Affected PCs include those with a Thunderbolt port and with kernel DMA protection enabled and Windows Hypervisor platform disabled. Microsoft has provided instructions for how to check the status of each feature. Even Microsoft's own Surface Pro 7 and Surface Laptop 3 could be seeing errors and unexpected shutdowns after installing Windows 2004 due to an issue with the always-on, always-connected feature. It affects devices with more than one always-on, always-connected capable network adapter. Microsoft has also found a compatibility issue with some games using game input, redistributable, and Windows 10 2004 that prevents mouse input on affected games. And there's a problem with apps or drivers using certain versions of aksfridge.sys or aksdf.sys and Windows 10 2004. The issue can prevent an installation of Windows or cause the system to fail to start up after updating. Finally, Microsoft is looking into a glitch with Windows 10 2004 and some older drivers for NVIDIA display adapters. Windows 10 devices with affected NVIDIA display driver versions might receive a stop error with a blue screen or other issues during or after installing the update to Windows 10 version 2004. The affected drivers are any versions lower than 358.00. Microsoft, why not just pull back the release of Windows 10 Build 2004? Release it when it is ready for prime time. I believe that all of us would rather miss the 6-month upgrade schedule cycle than having many of us spend inordinate time fixing the problems. Microsoft, this is a big screw-up.
Introducing Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. Game Kill Tech, the good, the bad, and the bogus. Documents from the CDC list several technologies that can attach to a home air conditioner to alter the air you breathe, but the CDC only recognizes one of them as able to kill microbes and warns against some of them that end up injecting poisons like formaldehyde, vaporous hydrogen peroxide, and ozone into the air.
Several sources make it very clear that there's nothing available that can sanitize the air in your home or your office. The word sanitize sets too high a standard. It means getting rid of absolutely every infectious everything in the air. If you drop that down a notch, from sanitize to disinfect, well, you can get that to happen. That's can, not necessarily will. The challenge is in not getting bamboozled by false or misleading claims. All the things that you want not to be swimming in the air are microorganisms. The CDC calls them microbes. They include bacteria, viruses, and fungi. Some experts argue that you can't kill them all because things smaller than bacteria never really were alive. Well, instead, they use terms like deactivate. Phooey on that. If you hear the word kill here, you'll understand that it may just be a synonym. A few weeks ago, in the Oh Say Can You UVC segment, you learned that UVC can kill that stuff if there's enough intensity and long enough exposure. One of the companies making UVC add-ins for HVAC systems sent a prototype of a new residential model that places four lamps inside an HVAC air handler. These are 17-inch long mercury vapor lamps built with a kind of glass that won't create ozone. How much kill are they good for? An expert from a different company helped with the math, considering the size of the air handler chamber, the speed of the ventilation fan, that airflow, and the intensity of the lamps. While the result is worth your attention, with four lamps, their intensity in concert with the exposure duration for microorganisms in the airflow provide a kill rate of 90% on each pass. Ventilation ducts typically cycle, maybe six times an hour. Think about it. The ducts throughout the house blow disinfected air into the rooms. And some of the total volume of the air in those rooms will get pulled into the return air ductwork. By the end of the day, for most houses, every cubic yard of air in every room will have been 90% disinfected several times over. First pass down to 10%, then 1%, then 0.1%, and so on. Now here's a question that might surprise you. Should you just turn the UVC lights on when the fan runs, or leave them on all the time, 24/7? The answer is to leave them on for several reasons. One is that even with the ventilation blower off, there are still convection air currents running slowly through the ductwork. And their slower air speed also means more exposure time in the air handler. So between blows, the air going through is close to 100% disinfected and keeps getting pushed through the house. Also, these mercury vapor lamps are the kind that need a ballast and a big kick to start them, which takes its toll on their electrodes. That expert said that the on and off damage to the electrodes takes big chunks out of the life expectancy of the lamps, often even bigger than simply letting the hours run by just leaving them on. Several UVC air sanitizing products from several vendors use similar high-intensity UVC lamps, but there are also products out there that cheat. They might use UVC LEDs, which today don't deliver anywhere near enough intensity and would cost a fortune if they did. Some use cheaper, lower-intensity lamps. Well, you can probably figure out that a UVC emitter that can disinfect a toothbrush with an 8-hour overnight exposure probably doesn't have the oomph to disinfect your air supply. Some of those products are terrible, just plain cheats. Just a cheap, for example, cheap glowing blue LED, entirely in the visible range, doing no disinfection at all. Remember, UVC technology is the only choice that the CDC names as effective against microbes. But still, be careful. There are two other technologies that use UVC as energy triggers to other processes. Both of those infuse harmful gases into inside air, things like ozone, vaporous hydrogen peroxide, formaldehyde, and more. There are some specific words that should raise red warning flags whenever you hear them. Catalyst or catalytic, peroxide, or anything that sounds like it has hydrous or oxygen in the term, flash, or a pulse, or strobe. One more time. Catalyst or catalytic, peroxide, or anything that sounds like it has hydrous or oxygen in the term, flash, or pulse, or strobe. There are other terms that you'll hear for technologies that are not harmful, that may be slightly helpful, but that really aren't disinfecting the air. Got that? Not killing microbes, but not evil. The list may surprise you. Terms like cold plasma, ionic, electrostatic. One more time. Cold plasma, ionic, electrostatic. Electrostatic filters pull a lot of dust particles out of the air, which is the same job that standard fabric filters also do. But in this case, electrostatic filters do it by creating electrostatic fields to charge dust or droplets in the air. Then draw those onto oppositely charged conducting metal sheets or plates or wires. You may already know that a lot of infectious microorganisms travel by hitchhiking rides on solid particulates like dust or droplets. An electrostatic filter can help yank those out of the airflow. Any allergies in your family? You might be thinking that a tight fabric filter like a HEPA filter or a high-value MERV filter can also block that dust and droplets from getting through. And they can, but only by adding a considerable amount of resistance to airflow. Unless the HVAC system at your place was designed from scratch to handle that extra resistance, one thing that's in the wind for you is an expensive early failure. Beyond filtering, there's a second, somewhat different approach to using electrostatics that, as it happens, suffers from the vocabulary that their makers use to describe them. Terms like cold plasma, which sounds bogus to begin with, but as it turns out, well, it really can work. Rather than localizing within the ventilation ducts, these devices electrostatically charge all of the air, mostly all of the droplets and particles that are riding in the airflow, so that they and the air are still charged when they come out into the room. Now, the walls in the room don't carry electrical charges. Neither does the furniture, the wall art, the TV screens, or the flooring. Those surfaces are all electrostatically neutral. So, when the charged droplets and particles come into the room, they'll get drawn onto those neutral surfaces. Which means that, oh boy, for the first 3 weeks to 3 months that you use one of these systems, your house will look like a dust blizzard hit. If you usually dusted and vacuumed once a week, you'll now need to do those chores every other day. If you had been changing your HVAC air filter every 3 months, those will get well clogged up every 3 weeks. There won't be any question but that the system is pulling a lot of little stuff out of the air. But then, after the first few months, it all settles down. Filter changes, dusting, vacuuming, that all goes back to their more relaxed, normal schedules. Anybody in the house with allergies is likely to feel relief. And any time there happens to be, for example, a surviving active virus in the air, well, when it comes into the room, it won't stay airborne very long. Now, about combinations, if you're able, if allergies are a problem or if anybody there might be especially susceptible to respiratory infections, there is nothing counterproductive about combining a high-intensity UVC disinfection add-in with an electrostatic air filter and a cold plasma system. You'll effectively assassinate those microorganisms. The droplets and particulates that get blocked in the electrostatic filter will reduce the amount of dust for the cold plasma system to handle. And guess what? There are secondary benefits. The fumes of volatile organic compounds like fuel gases and cleaning fluid vapors will get neutralized. And, shall we say, aromatic elements like litter boxes, diaper pails, and Taco Tuesday, those will be dramatically destinkified. Finally, just in case you or your HVAC pro makes some small error in choosing the specific brand or model to install among these countermeasure categories, there's one more piece of equipment, one we've discussed before, that's strongly worth considering. It's Yoohoo, U-H-O-O. You can read about it at YoohooAir.com or on Amazon, U-H-O-O. It's the most complete consumer-facing indoor air quality sensor bed available, using 8 advanced technology sensors to monitor 10 IAQ, indoor air quality, 10 IAQ factors. Now, including a virus index that's on Android, coming soon to iOS. It measures ozone levels down to 1 part per billion, that's billion with a B. It will also respond to VOCs, those volatile organic compounds, and to particulate matter, and a lot more. Medical experts are forecasting a confusing period arriving around October, when they expect the annual flu season to overlap a new bump in the COVID-19 curve. These countermeasures you just learned about can help you be prepared, not scared. Hey, you've lived this long, right? Next time, since you've just gone through so much info about strange things to do with your household air, we'll take a look at water, at why conditioned water and soft water aren't necessarily the same thing, and about perturbation, that's in the sense of agitation or churning, how that can let you get there without those heavy bags of salt pellets or any other consumables. That's next time in Water. Shaken, not stirred.
Thank you, Marty. And here I was using snake oil, and it had no effect at all. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and the Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting Thursday, June the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet via Zoom virtual meeting, and the presentation is Internet of Things and RFID tagging. Their website is bcug.com, and visit that website to get more information to get onto that teleconferencing. The Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, July the 2nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., via Zoom virtual meeting. Presentation is SharePower. It's a free business programming language, and their website is wpcug.org, and visit their website to get more information to participate in the meeting. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, July 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the presentation is Wix, W-I-X, via Zoom virtual meeting. And the website is nyacc.org. Visit the website for more information to join the teleconferencing. And the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will begin their general meetings on Friday, September the 11th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they'll be meeting via Amazon Chime. For those who are not familiar with it, you should get yourself familiar with Chime at Amazon.com. And for more information on how to join the conference, the website for the Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. Just to remember, wherever you are, we come together at 7 p.m. each day to give thanks and gratitude to the medical staff and essential workers. Ring a bell or make a joyful sound to show your appreciation for all those working on the front lines. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening and for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.